Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. America has a border problem, and it's a problem that threatens to violently unravel the illusion of a united nation. Congress has struggled to forge compromise. The latest effort is known as the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. It mandates that runaway slaves be returned to their masters. When men and women fleeing enslavement arrive in the northern states, they often arrive marked and mutilated before being carried home in chains without any recognizable due process. And Northerners are forced to face their culpability in America's slave tradition and ask themselves about the laws they must obey and the laws they must go to battle to change. Andrew Dalbanco's latest book is called The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves and the Struggle for America's Soul from the Revolution to the Civil War. The impeccably researched book immerses the reader into the earliest days of the American experiment and the struggle for what will come. Dalbanco is the Alexander Hamilton Professor of American Studies at Columbia University. He joins us on the phone now from New York City. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here with us in South Dakota.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
One of the first things that I think we could start with is really the complexity of compromise and how often this notion of compromise is at play in this book and in your research. Talk a little bit about the Constitution itself and how the founders decided to try to work these compromises into the language of the Constitution, even though they don't mention slavery as a word itself.
Right. Well, the reality, I think, is that when the delegates came to Philadelphia in 1787 from 13 separate states, well, actually only 12 because the folks in Rhode Island decided not to show up. When they came to Philadelphia to try to put together a new republic, at least that was the result of the convention, they were really there representing two countries. There was one in the South where slavery was the bedrock of economy and culture, where it was increasingly difficult for white people to imagine life without their black, quote-unquote, servants. And the North, where the enslaved population did exist, but it was much smaller, and it was quite clear that the North was on the road toward abolishing slavery throughout the states, and that happened within the next 30 to 40 years. Some states took longer than others. So facing the project of putting these two countries together into one required compromise. There was no way that Southerners were going to sign on to a new compact if their slave property was not in some way protected and guaranteed to them. And they were well aware, despite the fact that slave masters from the beginning were always happy to talk about how great slavery was for slaves as well as for slave owners, they were well aware that human beings do not want to be enslaved. And they were experienced, including such slave owners as Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. They were experienced with the phenomenon of getting up in the morning and finding that some of their slaves had run away. So they insisted that the Constitution had to include a clause that would guarantee, to paraphrase the language, that any persons owing service or labor in one state cannot escape that obligation by going to another state, but must be returned to those to whom the service or labor is due. That became the notorious Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution. I begin my book by remarking that Abraham Lincoln understood that there would have been no Constitution if this compromise, and there were other compromises as well concerning slavery, did not enter into the Constitution. So from the very beginning, the Constitution was a document that enshrined certain protections for the institution of slavery. And the founders understood that they were thereby postponing the day of reckoning when the issue of whether or not the United States would continue to tolerate slavery would have to be finally faced.
I think all of us have an understanding that the founders were complicated people and that they wrote about things like liberty while they, you know, had their own slaves. But I think this book is the first time I really have seen the research put in front of me where you see, you know, an actual advertisement to have a slave returned from Thomas Jefferson or a letter from George Washington. They weren't just sort of benevolent slave owners. They were people who, when those slaves ran from them, made efforts to have them returned.
That's true. And, you know, my sense is that when we think about our history, we tend to oscillate between either glorifying everything and celebrating figures like the ones you've just mentioned as people beyond reproach, or demonizing them and standing in judgment over them and saying, how is it possible that they were such hypocrites and we would certainly never act in such a way? I'm leery of both of those points of view. My sense is that none of us has ever met a person, certainly including ourselves, who is not full of inconsistencies and contradictions. The reality is that the Founding Fathers were born into a world where slavery was normal. There were no societies known to them where slavery had not existed. Slavery took different forms at different times, but the idea that the only virtuous society was one in which no human beings were enslaved was a rather novel, radical, revolutionary idea that began to pick up steam. And in fact, some of the people that you mentioned, Thomas Jefferson, writes very eloquently about the horrors of slavery. He says, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God's justice does not sleep forever. And he anticipated that slavery would at some point disappear. He said, the spirit of the master is abating, the spirit of the slave is rising from the dust. And George Washington repeatedly said he wished it would go away. He wished there would be some form of gradual abolition in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So they were torn, and they acted, of course, out of self-interest, just as we all do to some degree. And as we often try to do when we face an insoluble problem, we kick it down the road and hope that the next generation will figure it out. That's basically what the Founding Fathers did.
And this is very clear in your book, heartbreakingly clear in your book, but just for our radio listeners who might not have read it yet, this compromise and this, you know, these conversations and this conflict, you know, it's all well and good, but in the meantime, there are people who are suffering in extraordinarily cruel ways. And I want to talk a little bit next about these people who do escape and who are the fugitive slaves who end up in the streets. And we can jump ahead in a, you know, with the policy and the history a little bit, but I really want to focus on this notion that when they arrive. In some of these ads that say, you know, so-and-so is on the run, I've branded the letter M into her cheek, or he has, you know, notches in his ears where I cut, you know, the last time he escaped or whatnot. The people who are coming and really the Northerners have to confront what is happening on the slave, you know, in the relationship between slave and master, and it's horrific.
Right, well, you know, slavery, which is a word that I use frequently in the book and has already come up in our conversation several times, you can't avoid the word, but the word is an abstraction.
Yeah.
Just like words like discrimination or white supremacy. These are abstractions. And to get to the concrete human experience that lies behind the term is another thing altogether. I think that part of the drama of the story I tried to tell is that human beings who had the courage and the will to remove themselves from unbearable circumstances at great risk to themselves, because recaptured fugitives were facing even worse conditions than those from which they fled, and they very well knew that. But human beings who took those risks and took themselves to the North in search of freedom made it less possible for people in the North to wave slavery away as this abstract thing that existed somewhere else with which I have nothing to do. If a fugitive actually turns up in your neighborhood and you're faced with the question of whether you meet your constitutional and legal obligations by helping to turn him in, or you meet the obligations that seem to be exerted on you by your conscience, you're in a different relationship to slavery all of a sudden. You have to confront it yourself. You have to struggle with the kind of problem that some Southerners of conscience were struggling with. So the fugitive slaves helped to remind Americans, to teach Americans, that slavery was not a Southern problem, it was an American problem. Mm. And that's part of the power of the story.
And many of them told their own stories or had their stories sort of absconded with and told for them. What do we know about the people who survived to tell exactly what it was like at that time?
Well, they did indeed, and that began before the notorious law of 1850. In the 1830s and 1840s, as the traffic, as it were, out of the South began to accelerate, and an organized abolitionist movement took form in the North, anti-slavery people, both white and black, realized that putting a living, breathing, suffering, feeling human being in front of a crowd on a stage or to make a speech from the podium or to deliver a sort of sermon from the pulpit or to publish his or her story in a magazine or in some cases as a short book to tell the story of what they had dealt with in slave country was a powerful weapon on behalf of the anti-slavery struggle. I guess at one point I try to suggest that the strategy of the abolitionists and it was a kind of exploitation. They were using some of these fugitives for their own political purposes, but the strategy of using them to describe the human reality is very similar to what Dr. King did in the 1950s and 1960s when he realized that small children being attacked by police dogs or swept off the street by fire hoses or dragged or young men and women dragged to jail because they dared to sit at a lunch counter and order a hamburger, that if you could put those images in front of the American people, and Dr. King, of course, had the great advantage that television had come along, and he knew very well the power of television, that you could thereby force people to interrogate their own conscience. Is this okay? Do I really want this country to be this kind of country? And he moved the needle. We still have a way to go. But he moved the needle on public attitudes toward racial discrimination, segregation, and the like. And the abolitionists of the antebellum period before the Civil War were doing something similar. In a way, it was an act of faith in the people, not just of the North, but of the South as well, that putting the human story in front of them would make a difference. And I guess that's one of the reasons I wanted to tell the story over again.
And this is one of the things I think you do so masterfully, and you did it just there as you were speaking, as weaving this history into the history that we're living through, in the past years and today, as we look at this notion of, you know, sanctuary cities or the debate over what the federal government should be able to do and how some people want the federal government to be more powerful, but only if it's, you know, to meet the ends that they want met. And I think I realized right, reading this book for the first time, that I sort of had this assumption that as we try to figure out what the founders' intent was, that that was a contemporary problem. I don't know why I would have thought that, but I really learned at a deeper level that this was something that they were really struggling with from the very beginning, when the people who had written the documents were still alive. They were still trying to figure out what is the role of government.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the paradoxes, ironies, surprises, I'm not sure what the right word is, that I encountered in telling the story is that, we think of states' rights as a doctrine that has generally belonged actually to the South. John C. Calhoun, the great defender of slavery, believed fervently and sincerely that the federal government was potentially tyrannical, that the federal government had no business interfering with the property rights of South Carolinians, and those property rights at that time included the rights to own human beings as property. And you look all the way up to the 1950s and 60s, again, I mentioned Dr. King. The segregationists, George Wallace, who came out and stood in front of the schoolhouse door and said, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, was saying to the federal government, stay out of the business of Alabamians. You know, we're in charge of our own state, our own culture, our own way of life. Keep the government out of it. But all of a sudden in 1850, when the federal government interfered on behalf of slave owners and the Congress passed this merciless law requiring the return of slaves to the South with no rights to due process, and we can talk about that more if you like, suddenly Southerners became very enthusiastic about this federal government. Southerners were big fans of federal power. Southerners wanted the federal government to send troops into Boston to teach those Bostonians a lesson when they weren't complying with the law. And Northerners, New Englanders, who we would think of as the progressive left of the day, suddenly became states' rights. You know, federal government has no business coming to Boston and telling us how to behave toward our neighbors. So things got switched right around, and that's one example of how history is full of surprises and also how there are some parallels to where we are today.
And then you have this idea of people trying to figure out what is a law that I have to obey and when does my conscience override and what does that look like in such a young nation. You have judges who are very devoted to the law who, on the other hand, might hide a fugitive slave in their home or help them move on to the next safe house. So you have this sort of cognitive dissonance that people are having to face in a new way in the North, though they're wearing cotton that was woven out of or they're wearing clothes that was woven out of slave cotton too. So it's an incredible sort of cognitive problem.
Right. Well, one point that you've just made is that the fugitive slave law forced Northerners to recognize that slavery was not a Southern problem. It was an American problem, and they were implicated, and they had to decide how to behave in the face of these desperate refugees from slavery. The larger problem that you point to of what do we do when we are faced with a law that conflicts with deeply conflicts with our sense of justice. And, I guess I have to think that if there's any point in thinking about the past, it's because human beings in the past faced not the same problems, but problems with similar challenges as what we face today. So now I don't actually develop this particular analogy in the book, but as we're talking, there are a lot of people in this country who sincerely believe that abortion is a crime against truth and nature and God. And yet we live in a country where the Supreme Court has, at least up till now, ratified the right of women to control their own reproductive functions and thereby declared that abortion under certain circumstances is legal. Now, if you're such a person, if you're a person who believes it may be legal, but it's not just, you have a moral problem. How do you remain true to your own convictions and yet also a law-abiding citizen of a political entity that has courts and legislatures and rules whereby these particular laws have emerged? And we can think of many, many other examples. A lot of people feel right now that the actions of the federal government toward desperate refugees seeking to escape conditions in Central America that may not be technically slavery, but that are certainly not conditions that any of us would want to live, that the federal government is applying rules toward those people that we find abhorrent. So what do you do in those circumstances? Do you wait patiently and vote for candidates who have a point of view closer to your own? Do you give money to charitable organizations that you think will provide some relief for the people that you're concerned about? Do you become politically active, or do you become violent? And as we know, in some cases in recent years, we have seen people resort to violence in order to press what they believe from both the right and the left. We won't go down that road as to where the violence is more located these days. So my point is that this is not an antique problem. This is not a problem that is going to go away anytime soon. And so I felt engaged in telling a story of a particular moment in American history when the problem became very, very acute. And as you said, to begin this part of the conversation, judges sitting on the bench found themselves compelled to enforce a law that they didn't believe in. Mm-hmm. And that's a situation. I mean, I have a few friends who sit on the bench, and we all know lawyers who defend clients who they think are guilty, or maybe even prosecute clients that they're not sure aren't innocent. If you commit yourself to the rule of law, that's not the same thing as committing yourself to striving for what you regard as justice. So it's a human problem. It's a timeless problem. And I would like to think that people who read the story in this book will feel it's not just about the past, it's also about the present.